some more about this.
So apparently, the discussion today is so great that organizers decided to have two discussion leaders and one coordinator. So I'm coordinated. My task is basically to keep everyone on time. So if you want to make presentation, short presentation, or to ask questions, raise your hand. And let's not talk over each other. Let's raise hands and then talk once I point the finger at you. So, and this is number one. Number two, the discussion today will be different from the discussion that we had before. This time, the two discussion leaders decided to go with political pressure, and do the same as in the standard debates. So you will have segments, meaning that for 10 minutes you discuss one thing, for 10 minutes you discuss other things, and we switch from one to the other. So there's a list of what will be discussed, and Sean will start. So go ahead and start the first subject, which will be quasi-particle versus non-quasi-particle.
Okay, I mean, the vision was also that this discussion is going to be intertwined. Peter and I may just replace each other as
we can merge in one process.
That's the intertwining.
And the audience should be intertwined. Also, some of these topics are also quite intertwined, of course. So maybe before saying anything, we should remind ourselves what a Fermi liquid is. So this is about non-Fermi liquid transport, right, is the topic. So what about Fermi liquid transport? So we should just, it's good to fix ideas for 2 minutes, right? So in a textbook in a Fermi liquid, there are well-defined quasi-particles. And the very one way to see these in transport is to look at sigma omega, and one expects some kind of sharp Judah peak with a lifetime, but maybe the quasi-particle lifetime, or maybe some transport lifetime, which can only make it sharper. And so you can see a well-defined quasi-particle very clearly in transport in sigma of omega. The well-defined quasi-particles have various consequences, so you can calculate, for example, the resistivity as a function of temperature, the electrical resistivity. And there are actually all kinds of answers you can get depending what the scattering mechanism is, right? So these quasi-particles scatter off something that causes the resistivity, and so in Ashcroft-Merman, the answers you will find are t to the 0, t squared, t fifth, and t. Where this is disorder, this is electron-electron, this is electron-phonon, below the device scale, and this is electron-phonon about the device scale, okay? And so there are a series of very well-known answers, and we know what we're doing for all of those, but it's certainly not the case that it has to be t squared, okay? That's just one. In fact, that's, you need strong electron-electron correlations to get t squared, okay? Very good. And so another, the electrical conductivity is not the only transport. You also have the thermal conductivity, kappa. And so another canonical signature of a textbook Fermi liquid is the Wiedemann-Franz law, which is that kappa over sigma t, sigma is 1 over rho, is pi squared over 3, if I get units once, kb squared over e squared. And so the intuition behind this is that these quasi-particles carry both energy and charge, right? So the transport, the decay of both of them that matters. However, to get this, this is only true if you have elastic scattering. Because if you have inelastic scattering, it will degrade the heat faster than the charge, because every collision you lose energy, and so the heat goes down in addition. And so typically, that won't be true. However, at room temperature in conventional metals, this ratio is in this ballpark, certainly to within an order of magnitude, and actually quite a bit closer than that.
You also have to subtract the phonon contribution to kappa?
Yes, and you have to worry about phonons, that's right. This is kappa electron. But actually, I mean, back in, the original paper by Wiedemann-Franz, where they certainly didn't subtract anything, I mean, just take room temperature, kappa over T, and it's within factors of 2 or 3 of this number. Certainly not a factor of 10 or 100 or something like that. Indeed, let's put phonons. We'll come back to phonons.
Actually, phonons is also, they provide the source of
sorry,
at this temperature, but there is no direct phonon contribution to.
Is that clear? Yeah. So, of course, you need phonons to scatter the electrons, but we don't want to consider the contribution of the phonons to the thermal transport. And so actually what, and also because we'll come back, this will come back later, so actually what you, in, if you could do, if you could really subtract the phonons, what do you expect to get for L, since ratio is called L, against tau in a conventional metal, it looks something like this. And so at zero temperature, you have this impurity scattering that's elastic, and so Willem and Franz is exactly satisfied, this is L0, so this value is L, called L0, so L0. Then inelastic scattering starts kicking in, that degrades the thermal conductivity more, so it starts going down, but actually above the Debye temperature, the electrons are hot, but the phonons are cold, because all the phonon, any given phonon has energy below the Debye temperature. But the electrons are at energy above the Debye temperatures. The electron, in a given scattering, cannot give a lot of energy to a phonon. Okay, and so it's effectively elastic from the electron's point of view. So above the Debye temperature, scattering becomes elastic again. And so Willem and Franz is satisfied. And this is the same regime where you get this T-linear contribution. So for our discussion later, let's remember that one signature of electron-phonon T-linear scattering, T-linear resistivity, is that Willem and Franz should be satisfied, okay, with the pi squared over 3.
Performance are not that important here, just basically elasticity is important.
Right. Correct. Could there be any boson above
any thermal fluctuation for any boson?
Yes, yes, exactly. Very good. Okay, so that's all. Okay, and of course, being a Fermi liquid, if you can calculate everything, you know what magnetic fields do. You know what things like the thermal power should do. And so, of course, there are a whole host of observables that are very well controlled in a weakly coupled region. Okay. So, non-Fermi liquid is, I'm going to indeed use the negative definition. People have tried to propose positive definitions of a non-Fermi liquid, but a negative definition is that you try this for a few years and it doesn't work. So then you have two options. The less radical option is just that it's more or less the story, but you haven't identified the scattering mechanism properly. Perhaps you're not in the right kinematic regime. Maybe the disorder is long wavelength or something, as we'll come back to. The more radical option is that these quasi particles are not there, and you should not use the Boltzmann equation. Large N is misleading. Small epsilon expansion is misleading, and you should just do something else. Okay, those are two options that I at least have in my head. And some of the things that we're going to discuss apply to both of them. So, for example, in a minute we're going to start talking about hydrodynamic regimes. It's a natural consequence of not having quasi-particles, but it can also happen with quasi-particles in an uncommon, unfamiliar kinematic regime, okay, where, for example, disorder is very long wavelength or something like that. Right? Good. So then, when all that doesn't happen, you can ask, is it that there are quasi-particles, but we just haven't been clever enough to identify the right scattering mechanism or kinetic regime, or is it that really a very different formalism should, and a very different set of intuitions should be used? Okay. Good. That was all I wanted to say about this top bit. So I don't know.
Okay. Let's stop for a second. Does anyone want to contribute here? Any questions?
What about scattering processes?
So we're going to come to that. So that's going to come up right now. but we might as well preempt it, right? So this T squared, let's say you turn off disorder, then this T squared will also not be there unless there's unclap. So this T squared is specifically, certainly when it's the dominant. Exactly. If there's a T squared that's much bigger than a T to the zero, then that's unclap, and the point about unclap is that it relaxes momentum. And we'll come back to that. We're going to talk about that a lot.
An interesting, amusing point is that asymptotically going to zero, unclap will not do anything.
It goes like T squared, correct?
Yeah, unclaps cannot be effective. to the limit of t going to zero.
That's right. That's this t squared. Yeah. And actually, that so the way, one way of phrasing that is that in a RG sense is that when you've got your Fermi surface, so umklapp involves moving a pair of electrons around the Fermi surface in a momentum, and this is an irrelevant, in the RG sense, it's an irrelevant operator, and so it has to drop out as t goes to zero.
I'll put it slightly differently. Current is related to velocity and not to momentum, and so umklapp is equivalent to saying that at nearby momentum points on the Fermi surface, the velocity is different. So unless the Fermi surface is singular in momentum space, in the limit of t going to zero, umklapp cannot do anything.
I think it is like flat.
We're agreeing with the conclusion that it goes.
Do you see what I'm saying?
Actually, I don't.
Can I draw a picture?
Yeah, go ahead. I don't think that we need to discuss the Zetlon, but okay.
Obviously, this Didymon France works only in the limit when black conformal scattering is proportional to t. It breaks when it's t5, and etc. But my question is, which I don't know the answer, there are deviations from t squared for electron-electron scattering. For example, if t is not much smaller than the Fermi surface, the size
Fermi
of the Fermi energy. Would Widemann Franz be valid in this regime?
Not with pi squared over 3.
Would it be still constant?
It will be. It will depend on the scattering mechanism. So take the other limit. The temperature is much larger than the Fermi energy. You are in Boltzmann gas. Now this number is going to depend on scattering mechanism. And if you have some power law in one of tau with a function of temperature, this number will show up there. So it will be not as universal as the
Okay. Yeah, thanks for completeness. It's all transport, right? It can be tricky. You should surely actually list some dynamics, some cell specific heat, the Pauli, parametric condition, and in the modern era, photon emission. Right? Because photon emission tells you very directly whether there's glass particles or not.
So by definition, we're going to talk about transport today, one nice thing about transport is that it is only sensitive to low energy excitations. And so it
you do photon emission, which is one MeV resolution, you know, you're very deep infrared. And you see them
single. That's
also the resolution lost 30 years.
Yeah, but that's the issue, quasi particle versus non quasi particle, whether we actually can see them. Okay, maybe we can move to subject number 2.
So I'll start and then Mitya will come in a minute. So one, perhaps just an illustration of what a one way, theoretically controlled way of breaking some of this is to have a hydrodynamic regime. Okay, and so we're going to talk a little bit about that, and that's consistent, as I had mentioned, both we're going to see it's natural without quasi particles to enter a hydrodynamic regime, but it can also happen with quasi-particles. It's just an unusual kinematic place. We're going to talk about that a little bit. So even without so let's imagine for a minute that we don't have quasi-particles, just to start there. And then that means everything dies very quickly because things are scattering very strongly. However, things that have a tendency to survive are things that are associated with conservation laws. Okay, so quasi-particles means almost everything decays, goes to zero very quickly, okay? But of course, if something is conserved, there's some Q dot that's equal to some operator that's conserved, then that does not decay, right? So, for example, energy and charge are conserved, they don't decay. Energy and charge are not the most interesting ones. The most interesting case that we're going to talk about in a minute is the case where there's a long-lived momentum. Okay. So always, so energy and charge density, energy density, those are always conserved, but those are scalar quantities and they don't drag the current. Momentum is a vectorial quantity, and if that's conserved, it drags the current, and that can affect transport very strongly. And so in particular, if momentum were, if there were a vectorial quantity that were exactly conserved, then very, very general considerations tell you that the conductivity will be infinite. And in particular, we'll have more stuff, but it'll have a delta function at zero frequency, which is proportional to the susceptibility between the current operator and the momentum operator. Okay, so this is a measure of, in equilibrium, if I set up a current, how much momentum is there? Okay, you can't, momentum, and in fact this quantity is actually just a total charge density squared. Okay, so if you have a net charge, momentum implies current. Okay, there's no way around this, right? This is a theorem, if momentum is exactly conserved.
This is a real one.
Sorry, thank you. Yes. Yes. Very good. And so, right, so then, good. So this could happen. Now, also, if momentum is not exactly conserved, but approximately conserved, then, right, so, of course, this is not the case in the middle, okay? But if P is long-lived compared to single particle excitations, then you have a hydro regime, which means that you can solve over some scales a classical equation for a velocity field, V of x. Okay, so velocity is actually the source to momentum. Okay, so just so you know, velocity is to momentum what the chemical potential is to the charge and what the temperature is to the energy. Okay, it's the conjugate source, right? Yes.
So presumably it does depend, for instance, if you have a Fermi surface, on some properties of the Fermi surface, not just on the total area or density. That's all.
So good. Yes, thank you. So for example, the Galilean invariant Fermi surface, this quantity is n times m star, and then this is your Drude formula. So you can think of this as a mass, basically. But indeed, of course, that's where the geometry will come in.
Yeah, assuming that apart from things like charge and energy, that the only conserved quantity is the momentum.
So am I assuming?
Yeah.
Well, okay, actually, that's a long story. So, yes, here I am. And so, so I would call this minimal hydro.
Right. The question is whether... is this minimal hydro compatible with the existence of a Fermi surface?
Yeah, absolutely. Why was that?
No, once the Fermi surface is all the low energy description is all kinds of conserved quantities.
That's right. Oh.
So there's a certain number of things.
Right. So that depends what temperature regime you're at. Right. So you have to be in temperature. So what he's saying is that strictly at T equals zero, in a Fermi liquid, there are infinitely many conserved quantities, and that's never going to be hydrodynamic.
Well, even a non-Fermi liquid, if there is a Fermi.
No, but at a temperature, there's a T squared scattering, and so they're not strictly conserved, but momentum will still be conserved. So they're irrelevant operators about a Fermi surface.
Momentum will also not be strictly conserved.
No, but it's a different. But that has to do with symmetries. It's different. So you cannot get away from T squared. But how big the scattering of the single particles, but how big momentum conservation is, depends on how strongly translations are broken,
yeah.
Which is a separate issue. So you can perfectly well, in principle, have a hierarchy between them.
In relation to this discussion, there's something which is always conserved, which is density, which then ensures that the density-density correlation function have an explicit form.
Correct. Diffusive.
Hmm?
It's diffusive.
Just from the conservation law. And since there's also a continuity equation which dictates the relationship between current-current correlation and the density correlation, you get out the conductivity for free if you know the density correlations.
Correct.
And I personally find that very a nice way to think about the hydrodynamics in Fermi liquids and non-Fermi liquids, because the density correlation function, the function of Q omega, is in principle a measurable quantity. And it's recently been measured.
Yes, that's, but can I just repeat what you're trying to say? There's a
subject. Time.
Yes. I mean, yeah, but it's a good question. So it actually pertains, right? So I talk about momentum here, but indeed, let's say number densities and energy densities also is always conserved.
It's
and
always conserved.
Yes, it's always conserved. Yes, right. And so what that will guarantee for you is that at the very late scales, charge will diffuse. Okay, and that leads to a certain
dq squared or I omega plus dq squared.
Some form of the correlation function. And from this, there's a diffusion, and what you get from there is this Einstein relation with the connectivity is given by the diffusivity times some thermodynamic, and that's always true. Okay, and that's a type of hydrodynamics. However, when momentum is long-lived, there's more structure to hydrodynamics because you have a sound mode as well as a diffusive mode. Okay, so if momentum is exactly conserved, so now the hydrodynamic variables are not just n and epsilon, but the energy that also has a pi. And when you solve the hydros, the coupled set of this, you find there's a diffusive mode, which is what you had before, but it's also a sound mode.
Yeah, that gets a little tricky in a charge system because the conservation law which leads to sound mode goes to the plasmon.
That's okay, very good. So there's another subtlety we should talk about here. So indeed, what Chandra said is correct. That if you actually try to shoot charge through a charge medium, the sound mode gets lifted and becomes the plasmon, okay, because of screening. However, when we measure sigma of omega, and sigma of DC in Ohm's law. Okay, this E is the total E, it's not the external E.
Yeah.
And therefore, this sigma is the unscreened sigma, not the screened sigma. So
the Einstein relation refers to, in fact, the
unscreened
screen system.
No. So in fact, it's this confusing thing that the when you do hydrodynamics, you can forget about screening when you're calculating the conductivity. And so the modes that you put in hydrodynamics are not the actually existing modes in the system.
Okay, so then in that case, the first relation is enough. You just need to know the frequency and temperature dependence of the diffusion constant, assuming that the compressibility is finite.
Right, so what the existence of a sound mode will tell you, so if you have exact translation invariance, you'll find that this D is infinite. If you have weakly broken translation invariance, by solving the bigger system, you find that this D is related to the momentum relaxation rate. And so there's more structure.
Velocity.
Sorry, say again?
Velocity.
They're very closely, but they're basically the same thing.
They're never the same in a solid.
They're not equal. They're related by a susceptibility. In the same way.
Different.
Well, anyway. In the same way that you can think in terms of chemical potential fluctuations or density fluctuations, you can exchange energy fluctuations for temperature fluctuations. You can also change momentum fluctuations for velocity fluctuations. There's a one-to-one, not a trivial, but there's a one-to-one.
Who's next to be here?
Chandra's happy.
Is there anything?
These are good. I mean, one should go through this because there is a form of hydrodynamics that's just always true, which is diffusion, okay? And that's hydrodynamics, in a sense, has to do with conserved qualities. When you have a conserved momentum, there's extra structure. This remains true if the momentum's weakly relaxed, but you get more because you can relate this D to the way momentum decays. So there's extra structure on top of what we all agree. Yeah.
Just a short question. This is something that always confused me. So following up on Chandra, so you're saying in a charged system, there's actually no diffusing.
As we know from high school, if you take a metal and you put a lump of charge there, it decays exponentially, exactly, and it does not diffuse.
So how do you define sharply the quantities in that equation?
So to obtain that result, you take the equations for hydrodynamics and you couple them to a dynamical photon, and you'll see that this equation gets some damping. There's some screening that goes here, and then the pole decays exponentially and it doesn't diffuse. Right? Nonetheless, and then if you use this propagator, you will not get the Einstein relation, which we all know is true in a metal. Okay, so you have to. So technically, the way you see it is that this E is not the it's the one bubble. So this conductivity is this. It's not this. Okay, because this is the effect of the screening. Okay, and so similarly, this E is a total E. It's not the theorist E, right? The theorist E, you put in a source, and this is the total E, and so these bubbles also appear and they cancel, and so the connectivity that goes here is the unscreened one. I shouldn't be telling you guys this. All right. Okay, but so momentum, a long-lived momentum constrains the system. So I wanted to say one thing, and then we'll let. So there's recently been a lot of progress in certain systems looking at the consequences of the existence of this momentum. Okay, and you certainly get non-Fermi liquid physics. So one effect is the following: when you have a long-lived momentum, then there's a velocity field in the hydrodynamics. And so normally velocity is not a single particle velocity, okay? This is a collective velocity field, okay? And so now suppose you have this is your conductor and it has a fixed width W. And then this is your hydrodynamic metal, okay? So it has a long-lived momentum. But the sides are something else that don't have a long-lived momentum, which is most stuff. And so the momentum is forced. It's a question of what the boundary conditions are. One plausible boundary condition is the velocity has to be zero at the boundaries, because the velocity field doesn't exist outside of the sum. And so what happens is the velocity field will get a profile, because it's forced to be zero here, and it gets something like this. Okay, so with the velocity field, because the velocity is forced to zero on the boundaries, but the current is carried by velocity, it's forced to be inhomogeneous. Okay. Within hydrodynamics, an inhomogeneous velocity field, the gradients of the velocity field generate entropy. They create heat because of the shear viscosity, right? So shear is, you have your medium, you try to move this plate, the other plate wants to move as well. Okay, so it's transverse, dx or dy. Okay, the transverse velocity squared, and this generates entropy, heating. All right, so this is really the definition of viscosity. Okay, so viscosity is when you have a transverse thermal gradient, the viscosity tells you how much a thing heats up. But we also know from Joule heating, this argument doesn't get everything exactly right, but it gets the essence right. Okay, so what is it? So this is viscosity over width. This gradient is like this width. Okay. Width squared times the velocity squared. And Joule heating will tell you this is the resistivity times the current squared. But the current is closely related to the velocity. So this goes like resistivity times velocity squared. We cancel these. And so the resistivity goes like the viscosity divided by the width squared. Okay. And so what this hydro regime leads to is a strong width dependence of the resistivity that absolutely would not be there in a conventional metal, because this viscous effect only exists because the velocity field is a macroscopic field. Okay, in a conventional metal, it's essentially ballistic, and you don't have this collective velocity field. So there was an amazing paper, I think, I'm biased, but a very beautiful paper on the compound I never heard of before, but maybe on this WP2. Okay. And so the paper is 17.06.05925 by Guth, Goth, et al. And so they measure the width. So what they measure the width dependence. So this is pretty right, it's pretty recent, just in time for my talk. This discussion. And so they plot. They have four different widths, which are actually quite different. And they plot the logarithmic dependence of the resistivity on the width. And it goes from width to the zero at high temperatures. And at low temperatures, it goes down to width to the -2. Okay, which is so the most robust signature you could hope for. Well, one very nice signature of hydrodynamic transport is this. And I think this is the first. There were earlier papers, for example, on palladium, cobalt, something. Which
there are papers in the 1870s studying it in classical liquids.
Absolutely, yes, of course. That, thank you. Yes, that's right. This is you know, water in a pipe. You know, this will happen. Yes. Yes. In a metal. So right. So I think there's very recently been a very compelling observation of this in a metal.
Just not to advertise myself, but there is an earlier paper in quantum point contact shows in graphene quantum point contact clear W squared dependence.
Okay.
Okay. I mentioned it on Tuesday, but okay.
There are variations on this theme, if you have constrictions. So basically, anything you can do that sets up a flow with a gradient of V in it is going to have viscous effects if it's hydrodynamic. Okay, and so if you have current going through a constriction so that it starts expanding on the other side, this expansion here leads to a grad V that leads to a viscous effect. Yeah.
In this constant phosphorus, what's the temperature dependence of the resistivity in this regime?
Yeah, it's very interesting, actually. So they have three separate measurements, and this is just one of things that make a consistent story. It depends on the width, but in this regime, where it's sort of bulk, it's actually T-linear for a reason that I certainly don't understand. So the resistivity looks something like this, and then depending on the width, it does something like this. So this is the width. This is the width dependence. And actually, these are like several orders of magnitude. It's T linear.
So viscosity is linear.
This regime is not the viscous regime. Presumably, because it doesn't.
Still, it is in sign. It is metallic.
Right. It's metallic, yes.
As opposed to what we...
Oh, that's right. Yeah. So they don't... Good. Well, do you even want to say something? Maybe I feel I'm talking...
No, that's fine. I'm feeling this very well.
It's related. So what the question... An interesting thing is, so in a Fermi liquid, the viscosity is like a conductivity. So there's something counterintuitive. This relates a resistivity to a viscosity. But actually, from the point of view of sort of Kubo formulae and so on, the viscosity is more like a conductivity. It's a transport coefficient, right? Is that even true?
Yeah,
that's true. Yes. This should go like one over T squared in a Fermi liquid. Okay. Which means that the resistivity should actually turn around and go up again. Okay. So this Gerze effect, I think. So you might have expected, right? Exactly. If this is true, there should be an upturn. And I actually asked the guys about this, and they're saying they possibly see hints of it at down here, but there's not an upturn there. So if you extract the viscosity from this, it doesn't look like that. It looks quite different.
Behavior, so something to look on archive and literature, yeah. But it's quantum point contact geometry.
Yes.
appreciation, can you say how the strictly would best interpret you taking the data literal? Is it like linear with you?
So this thing is linear. At
low temperature. Would you sketch you think it's more like T squared, whatever?
Yeah, it's a very good question. I can't reproduce it. Someone should look up the paper.
Just from what you drew, it looks like it's a power.
Yeah, but there were some logs on this plot, so I'm not sure what I'm plotting. I think this axis was logarithmic. So,
you don't see this upturn because at very low temperatures, hydro itself is not applicable since this thing has a Fermi surface.
That's a theory.
No, in order to see upturn, you have to have your electron-electron scattering lengths shorter than the distance between impurities. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you destroy your hydrodynamics.
And so it's not like a feeding system, it's not necessarily extremely clean, right?
Yeah.
And it has to be personally.
Yeah, exactly.
But I think one should look at exactly. This should give you the temperature dependence of the viscosity, which is an interesting thing. And I don't know. So I feel right. So to end on this bit on a question. So one question is whether. So I think it's now established in graphene, and this is very simple that this in principle can happen in a metal, right? And it definitely leads to phenomenology that's not what you'll find in Ashcroft at the moment. And it might or might not be consistent with quasi particles. So one. Question is whether is this relevant? Is anything in this class of ideas relevant to famous non-Fermi liquids Couperes, heavy fermions, and so on and so forth? Okay, and for that one would like some experimental signatures, and cutting up your sample may not be the easiest of experimental signatures. And so that will be something we'll talk about more.
Okay, so I just wanted to make a short remark on the relation between the hydro regime, which is not very conventional for us because we kind of grew up with Boltzmann equation. As far as transport is concerned, and our hydro. And this is actually somewhat subtle issue, because of course we know that Boltzmann equation is more general than hydro, and we should be able to derive our hydro from Boltzmann. However, if you take a Boltzmann equation in its simplified form, that's what we are typically doing, let me sketch it like this, so we have DCKs spatially in invariant system, and then I will put in two convergent integrals. One is responsible for electron-electron interaction, and the other one is responsible for electron impurity interaction, and I will keep it in the simplest possible form, which is an angle average distribution function minus the actual function. Divided by the jurisdiction term. So now suppose that the system before we put in impurities was a Galilean invariant. So just empty space, particles are the dispersion k squared over 2m. And then the electron collision integral conserves at the moment, which means that the sum of this integral with the momentum is equal to 0. And so now it is very easy to show that regardless how strong electron-electron scattering is compared to electron impurity one, there is no effect on the resistivity from electron-electron interactions. You basically just multiply your Boltzmann equation by k, you sum over k, this guy drops out, this gives you the current, and I solved my problem because on the right-hand side I have the current, and on the left-hand side, I have the field, so I found the proportionality coefficient, and my conductivity is purely Drude. It does not depend on temperature. And I will go through the crossover between electron-electron and elastic mean free paths without notice. But of course, this is not true,
right?
Because we know that, we feel that viscosity should somehow enter, because we know that honey doesn't flow the same way as water, right? Okay, so whereas the catch is that here we assumed, we applied, if you wish, a Matissian rule at the level of other collision integrals. We didn't add other scattering rates, we know better, but we still added other collision integrals, and what we neglected was the correlation between the two effects. And I'm not talking about a quantum mechanical interference. This is simple, plain, classical correlation, because each impurity is an obstacle. It produces some turbulence, if you wish, some vorticity around this flow. And at the same time, electron-electron interaction is going on, so you cannot really separate these integrals. So what if I don't do this? And then there are two regimes. One is when Hydra does this. And this is the regime where all energy scales in other problem are larger than the electron-electron mean free path. So let's go for what will be the name, Stokes regime. So in systems, let's say, which have no confinements, orifices, et cetera, we can think about large impurities or long-range disorder. The size of an impurity is larger than an electron mean free path, which can be, again, larger than other wavelengths. And so in this regime, hydrodynamics works at all scales. Anywhere from impurity, I am in a hydro regime. Then all one has to do is to solve the Abelian Stokes of this kind. I need to balance the force acting on all electrons from the field with the Stokes force. 4.65, depending on the boundary condition, number of the balls in here, times the velocity of the flow, times viscosity R coefficient, and I found a relation between the velocity, that is the current, and the field, and that gives the formula similar to what Sean had here, with the resistivity proportional to viscosity. Okay, so if we have, for example, long-range disorder, and this is the team which was used by Spivak, Andreev, Kivelson, then there is no issue of the existence of the hydrodynamic regime in its full-blown form. However, suppose that, which is more often the case in strongly collected systems, although we'll probably come back to this when we're talking about linear resistivity, our impurities are not that large. They are comparable to the Fermi wavelengths, which is much smaller than the inelastic mean free path. And to be in kind of a quasi-hydro regime, the electron mean free path is going to be much smaller than the electron impurity one. So I have a flow of liquid. Electron-electron collisions are fast. I have viscosity, but I cannot use Navier-Stokes on all the scales because my obstacles are small. Okay. So what happens in this case? The conductivity is Drude. Plus there is a correction due to a breakdown of the assumption that electron-electron and electron impurity scattering events are uncorrelated, and because it comes about due to the fact that there is a flow around the impurities, which have finite size, this correction is proportional to the size of impurity. And so this is the result of the paper by Raska and Spivak, that in this regime, the conductivity is going to be the Drude conductivity due to a disorder only, plus a correction of order of the size of an impurity over the electron-electron mean free path. So if the size of the impurity goes to zero, we go back to Drude. So that gives the same sign of the temperature dependence as in the Stokes regime. However, here we're talking about a small correction. And I think the issue which we kind of want to discuss here is, I'm sure that the kind of Stokes regime, where we have full-blown hydrodynamics, is relevant to systems which we're interested in.
Relevant or irrelevant? Relevant or irrelevant?
Whether it is relevant, or whether there are cases where it is relevant.
Okay, Rafael first.
So, can you just spell out the, if I have a Fermi liquid, or if I have quasiparticles, whatever, what condition should I look for to go to the hydrodynamic regime?
Okay, I would say, well, I need to speak in terms of mean free paths. I need to speak in terms of mean free paths, which is not really a quasi-particle thing. Sorry, not really non-quasi-particle thing. But if you have a size of an object, which could be a correlation length of its disorder potential, the size of the orifice and constriction, the electron-electron mean free paths should be the shortest of other scales, which could be the size of this obstacle, the distance between these obstacles, the mean free paths due to scattering of these obstacles in the elastic, the way, etc., etc. So we want to go to the shortest possible scale here. Then you are in Stokes. You don't need to know your Boltzmann equation. Then you don't really care whether you have quasi-particles or not, because Stokes equation supersedes the Boltzmann equation. You go directly to the viscosity, and then you ask someone, for example, who is dealing with holography, to give you the answer for the viscosity. If you're in this intermediate up regime, I'm afraid that we need to know a bit more. We cannot just get away with viscosity one.
And so just to complete, and do we know why tungsten and phosphorus 2 display this behavior?
I don't know why why there is no insulating
so behavior. is it just because it, what makes this system behave in the hydrodynamics?
Finite size.
It's very clean.
Finite size, clean.
Very clean.
Finite size, clean. And I presume real to be strong electron.
But isn't it
minus 8 ohm centimeter low temperature?
Okay, so let's go forward.
I just want to understand one thing. If it's just like you have a. So you expect that any material or any Fermi liquid that I have clean enough, I would see that.
Well, you need to have some size. Right? You need to measure your flow on a size, on a scale, which is larger than the electron mean free path, right? When you do an orifice, when you do a point contact, okay, you put it by hand, it's there, and as we saw from Andrei, it works pretty beautifully. But if we have a large sample, our obstacles are impurities, and we need to go around them. Now our question is whether Hydra is as useful in this situation as it is for pipes and constrictions.
Yeah, just curiosity, when you do this Haskell's prefab whatever exercise, this correction, assuming it's a Fermi liquid, that's how the electrons get engaged with Q squared, would you produce a T squared temperature dependence on it?
Yeah. Because the prefactor is temperature independent, so it is a T squared, but it has the opposite sign to the T squared term in under resistivity. Because this is sigma Drude plus something proportional to T squared, so it will be minus T squared in under resistivity. It's going to be downwards.
Which makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay. So just one in the comment to answer to Rafael, but there's an extra assumption that you need, right? That the non-UNCLAP electron-electron scattering is much shorter than the UNCLAP
one. Well, yeah, so let's put it in here.
That's included there.
Yeah. So let's say this is
all non-momentum conserved.
Right. Momentum, so that the word is UNCLAP and let's see, momentum conserving and non-momentum conserving. This includes advantage of conserving.
Okay.
Just one small comment is that in viscous regime, and it's important that Matissean rules can break.
Yeah.
We know this from classical liquids and etc.
And that's
one of the fundamental signatures. Yes, that breaks. And question, okay. Conceptual question. What I don't understand, why, philosophically speaking, it's so difficult to put magnetic field into into hydrodynamics.
Not for Ian, he did.
Okay,
Michael, yeah, okay. So they hold the field together and put it in. But it's now a fluid dynamics of charged liquid, which has the substitution and channeled to.
A background non-static B field is completely straightforward to add, and it's been done many, many times. And in fact, the results have been, for example, one of the papers that was in the same polymer sciences, this is the graphene one, was on actually also on graphene, and they were
No one measures hydrodynamics in magnetic.
Okay, so if I just
fields, yeah.
May express my own curiosity, what kind of I'm really puzzled here, not puzzled, but something which I want to understand, is that we know precisely which diagrams from the Kuba formula give us this. And these are the series of self-energy and vertex collections of the ladder type. Sum this, we get the same result as the Boltzmann equation, or we can even rederive at the Boltzmann equation. Kuba formula supersedes everything. It is exact. So there should be some special diagrams which are responsible for hydrodynamic correlations which take you out of the Boltzmann equations. As far as I know.
Lifestyle and the
immediate
quasi particles.
No. So.
How much smaller than the
energy? Okay. If you start to do this, for example, you get out of the Boltzmann equation for a different reason. This is called Altschuler-Aronoff. Right. This is our quantum interference between electron-electron and electron-Purkinje scattering. We can be completely classical. We can be in Boltzmann gas, right? And one needs to. Maybe one needs to find a way to resolve the diagram and to get a better handle.
One, two, and then we'll go to next.
I'm very sure it's just going to get back to only to micro breakdown of Matisse. Right? So when you look at this, again, this Spivak, you saw, there's N time Matisse, right? You add them.
Yeah, you add the conductivity.
The question becomes then, what do you have to do is something like a tungsten diphosphide? To see this, what kind of experiment? But it's partially there, right? Because but when you cross over, then
well, what they see is they see a finite size effect first of all, right?
Yeah, and basically, it is this anti-Matissian behavior that's very naturally in this cross over regime.
We do see anti-Matissian behavior. That conductivities sum up rather than resistivities in the case of quantum point geometry. Yeah.
You said specifically when we were discussing the collision integral that the terms which sort of violate the separation you wanted to talk about were the semi-classical ones, and you didn't want to talk about quantum interference. But those diagrams that you just drew are quantum interference diagrams. So how do I know in a given system whether
so
those
the one which I added as a vertex are
right. If I have a given system. I could have either one of these effects, and is there a way to sort of a priori rule out that those are important?
No, so you'll have both.
You have both, right.
Because there are two ways to evaluate the Boltzmann equation,
right.
Are quantum and are classical, mm-hmm. And you have to choose your mean free passes such that one regime is more important than other. So, for example, quantum interference is a low temperature phenomenon. You want the left-and-left mean free pass to be at the longest. In a hydro regime, you want just to be at the opposite. And this is not the other diagram which will do hydro.
Okay.
Okay.
just a simple question. So this this breakdown of Matissian rule, is that a requirement for one to be in a hydrodynamic region?
No, it's a consequence, I would say.
Consequence.
Yeah, consequence. But you know, kind of, if you want to look at it visually, this is this impurity and this is flow, right? As in a textbook on hydro, so the other fluid lines go around, you cannot separate them.
Okay, we are almost an hour. Go ahead.
So there's various conditions there. So LE is much smaller than three different things. So potentially, for the size difference and so on, should R be the first thing that
Right, so for the size dependence, I think first of all you need to be ballistic. That is, a disorder should not be relevant when you go through other point
cloud. But the wire shorter than the other two.
Then this is the distance between impurities.
Oh,
okay, that's not relevant. Yeah, okay. This is the size. This is the diameter of the pipe, if you wish, and then you have to be below the pipe diameter.
So the regime in which LEE is much smaller than LI, which is much smaller than other scales.
Right, but so what happens in this wires? This is the system size. Mm-hmm. And scales related to disorder are presumably larger than other system size. So you're ballistic at very low temperatures, but once you turn on a heat a little bit, you get into hydrodynamic regime. Mm-hmm. So a quantum wire can be ballistic if you don't think about electron and electron interactions that will have this E square root of H, but as Levitov showed, as you take into account electron, your conductance actually goes above E square root of H. I think he also mentioned this. And this is because you add conductivities. Mm-hmm. Your conductivity becomes larger than 2 square root of H.
But should we expect the other limit to be conventional or not? If LEE is much smaller than LI and that's much smaller than any size.
Then you go back to Drude.
Sorry?
Then you go back to Drude. How the crossover happens? That's
an issue. Is completely conventional.
Sorry?
If LEE is much smaller than LI, which is much smaller than other things.
LEE is much smaller than LI, then we're probably talking about these small impurities. Right? Small impurities, which are still weak in the sense that the electron impurity metric pass is still long.
Yeah.
Right? Then it is still non-Drude. Because you have this hydrodynamic correction of viscous correction to conductivity.
Okay. So we are almost half time, so let's move to the next section. So from hydrodynamics, we go back to, I think, more familiar to most of us, linear impurities give you the number of supposedly non-Fermi liquid and supposedly quantum quick collections. You continue, right?
Yes, I'll ask.
Okay, I will erase. Yeah, but if you want to discuss some of them, so try to.
Yeah, not that fast.
No, go. Let's go to clock.
All right, so I think my philosophical approach to what we just discussed is that hydro is one, in principle, way of getting non-Fermi liquid stuff, and it may or may not be relevant for what we're about to talk about now. But there's this box, and hydro is one way of getting outside the box. There are likely other ways. Good. And the interesting thing is that this is attempting a more positive notion of a non-Fermi liquid. So many non-Fermi liquids have certain things in common, which a priori is surprising because they're in quite different, microscopically different systems. So let's say something about resistivity going like T. So of course that is possible within a completely conventional framework, but this comes with other signatures that can also be checked. For example, available in France.
Question, will you be speaking about asymptotically low temperature T?
Coming right up.
Otherwise it's
perfect. No,
otherwise
yes.
It's pointless.
This is exactly good. So that's exactly the right, exactly what I was about to say. So let me just say a few things about where this is seen. Okay, so it's seen quite a lot, but in various different places. So it's often in what looks like some kind of quantum critical fan. That's just the definition of that is just that it's often sandwiched between something that looks more conventional schematically, a bit like this. This is temperature and this is something else. It's can be seen, it often happens in asymptotic high temperatures.
very high temperatures. So, for example, in cuprates, I just looked up last night, so in actin VO2 or in strontium.
I think
it
means low temperature.
I'll talk about low in a minute. So T goes to infinity. So in all of these compounds, you have this linear resistivity up to, 600.
Up where the wire is melted.
800.
Lower
1,000 Kelvin. Very good. The lower limit here is a metal insulator transition at 300 and something. Here the lower limit actually it stops being linear below some temperature. I figured
the system is still much smaller temperature scale than Fermi energy.
Oh, of course. Yes. Sorry. EF is doubly infinite. Yes, in this way. So T is of course over everything. Well, probably much less than EF. But high human scales.
What's this non-Hamiltonian compound?
It's SR2RU04. But there are actually several of them that have.
I don't know which one it is because it's RU2.
It's RU2.
It's 214.
Yeah, but he's talking. So there's several, and these, very high temperatures, very good. Oh, and this one, of course, it can go down to it. I mean, I think the cuprates. I was trying to find a counter example to Jan, but cuprates are really special, and it really goes from zero to infinity. Essentially. So what's the upper, what's the highest T at which T linear goes? Asymptotically low in some, so certainly, for example, I think there's in some heavy fermions. Well, okay, there's always issues about superconductivity, other orders popping up and hiding your T-linear. You mean strictly T goes to zero.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, actually, so what? There we have definitely cuprates.
Down to 30 millikelvin.
And I think there's some pretty low, at least by human scales, and heavy fermions. Yes.
I think we also have to put cleanness of material on the scale.
I'm getting it. Let me get there in a second. So the point is, these things are seen sometimes. They're very high, but they don't go to low temperatures. Sometimes it's very low; they don't get to very high temperatures.
Sometimes
neither. Yes. Yes. Both high and low. Yeah. Yes. In particular, famously in the cuprates. Yes.
And you're also saying it's conventional material.
Copper has a T-linear.
That's also on this.
Yeah, that's asymptotically high.
That's also yes.
But they have to be above the Debye scale. 50 to 60 kelvin. Okay, so let me say two more general things. So right here at low T is where the connection to quantum criticality is most suggestive, but it is true, and so in particular this was emphasized in this Brunetau 13. That many of these, in both cases, conventional, unconventional, high T, low T, if you try to extract a time scale from, they did the following exercise, which is something you can, it's a well-defined procedure, it may or may not make sense, theoretically, but you have data on the resistivity, you write down the Drude formula, you do quantum modulations, you measure M, n, and the resistivity and refractive time scale. And we try to be careful about number of bands and so on. And so in a wide range of materials, they found the time scale, which Yang calls the Planckian time scale, which is this kb over t. Okay? And it's somewhat surprising that, you know, so in these low temperature cases, this has a very quantum critical smell to it. But I mean, I think it's legitimate to wonder how quantum criticality is influencing anything at 1,000 Kelvin, where the scale is still there. Okay, so I think one question. So that's why the variety of these systems is important. But there are also things in common which is potentially confusing. Right. So there's a question of whether do you expect to find, you know, five different explanations for the different regimes, or is there some universality?
Sure.
Yes.
So this Druin et al. Analysis, by now, to what extent has this been corroborated from optical measurements of tau?
So good. Some of the data points in that plot, actually, they are optical. And they, so in the Coupe rate, for example, they actually used optical to get the time scale.
They included copper.
They included copper, yes, in the T-linear regime.
Yeah, so in copper, the optical slacking rate is that linear t?
I actually don't know, but that must be known.
It is
kBt over h bar. No. Okay, it is. Number will change between aluminum and copper and some.
Is it order 1 or is it order 10?
It's order 1, but for every photon interaction, that's actually how it happens. There is a nice cancellation between energy scales. Coming from the Fermi energy and the information potential constant. And as a result, if you kind of do a back off of the end of the log estimate, it is a number of order 1.
Mm-hmm. The party for conventional electrophonic.
Yeah, for sure.
Tom, what was that comment? Say it again.
Departing from conventional electrophonic coupling.
Departing from?
Conventional.
What is departing from?
It's starting from or starting, not starting from?
Starting from, defined from.
See that you can get that thing in
English. Thank you. All right.
Asymptotic high temperature. When you're seeing at lower temperatures phonon dominated resistivity, the scattering rate is simply some coupling constant, which is of order 1 usually, times the total integrated spectral weight of phonons, which is of order 1 per unit cell. Right?
Yeah.
And therefore, since this T is, the coefficient of T is just that, the coupling constant times the integrated spectral weight of phonons.
Which happens to natural, be one.
So it's completely natural that at high temperature the physics is trivial.
Yeah. The H bar comes in where from the coupling constant?
Sorry?
The H bar, and this, where does it come from in this expansion? Is it just in the coupling constant?
But units depend on
the unit field. Okay, but if you're a classical physicist, you're not allowed to use H bar when you do dimension analysis.
No, the number of oscillators that you excite
is in units of H bar.
P over H bar omega.
It looks that you are putting discussions at two almost equivalent puzzles. One is up to what high temperature linear integrated skippy work. On the other hand, down to what possibility low temperature. I guess from the point of view theory, the second one is much more interesting than the first one.
Which one, high or low? Sorry.
Low. Low. Because high temperature is basically, there are Zener's explanations why at high temperature you get linear integrated skippy.
I mean, it's just a question of taste, but I think the high temperature limit is quite interesting. Not of course, the phonon one, which we understand.
No, but take something like VO2 or some other magnetic material. Or the effective scale there is the spin fluctuation scale, which is usually Fermi energy divided by a large number of the order of 20 to. And then again, the same phonon physics comes there at high temperatures with respect to the
It's only guaranteed due to thermal fluctuations.
Let me say, because this might tie in with another point that. So one thing that is interesting about the high temperature limit is that you go above this module of Rego limit, and that may or may not. So in this high temperature limit, unlike in copper where you do not, right? So the module of Rego, so many of the, in fact, all of these violate the module of Rego limit, meaning the resistivity is let's call it rho zero, bigger than supposedly the bound. So this has, but it's not yet classical.
Right, but let me try to address the question. If somebody will come up and say, I know the mechanism that gives you linear resistivity at the lowest possible temperatures, do you think that this should be the same mechanism that extends to high temperatures?
I think that's the question. I don't know.
But in the chip case, the slope is the same.
Yeah,
okay. So it can hardly be different.
Right, the question is,
what's
the Kelvin? Is
it
a high energy scale, or is the scale
only
100 MeV?
If you know the energy scale, it's more like 3,000 degrees in the Cooperation, the frequency dependent scale.
So, I mean, an argument that I've been tempted by in the past for that observation is that if there's a bound, you know, different cars on the freeway are going at the same speed, it's not because their motors are all the same, it's because there's a speed limit. So one way you can have different mechanisms, but like the same. The resistivity doesn't seem to care as if it's saturating a bound, but logic, as a purely logical point, that's a possibility.
So are you saying, or you are not saying, that linear temperature dependence is a smoke and gun of non-Fermi, non-quasi-particle behavior? It seems to be you started with saying, if we have linear temperature dependence, we might have a non-Fermi liquid regime, but now we came to the fact that saying, okay, it's nothing special about temperature dependence.
Yeah, but that's adopting as a one-sided
temperature.
So, if you look at resistivity against temperature, and let's do copper in its T-linear regime, it's doing something like this. Okay, if you now put any of these guys on the same plot, it's up there. Okay, so and the module for Rego limit is here.
Yeah.
So now
what is important is the absolute value at the same, which is when you calculate per whatever unit thickness, it should be of the order of h u over square.
So okay. I mean, this is one of the things.
Quite a difference, not a quantity. In some sense, it's like different for the liquids, with different schedule.
Well, that's a question. I mean, right.
In relation to Andre Gagne's question, if the resistivity is going as T down to the lowest temperature, then there is a minimum condition that this single particle scattering rate is also going as omega of T, which means that the real part of the scattering is going as log of omega of T, which by Kramers Kronig, which is the statement that there's a singularity at T equal to zero.
In other words, if linear resistivity or any power smaller than T, then it's down to the lowest temperature. This definitely means that there's no well-defined quasi-particle. This is the definition of non-Fermi.
So maybe just to summarize these, because actually this is a good, maybe it's useful, the relation to non-Fermi liquid. I think at low T, it should be non-Fermi liquid for the reason Chandra was just saying. And at high T, the argument for non-Fermi liquid is a different one, and it has to do with this logic.
But how do you define non-Fermi liquid at high temperature?
You should not define. We're less than EF.
Okay, we're not.
What's the difference at finite temperatures between large scattering, small scattering? It's qualitative, it's not quantitative.
If T is about the phonon energy scale, then you should refer to that scale and not the Fermi energy.
But the phonon, as you know, the phonon energy scale is like there, right? Also in these plots.
You're the first.
I was just wondering what is the phonon by.
It's in the middle of the T linear regime.
Middle of the T linear.
Go next.
So I guess. Maybe you were planning to mention the insensitivity to disorder. Yes, so that's just wanted to comment that maybe that's related to the fact that you don't see anything also at the about the Debye phonons acted some effectively as a disorder potential. So you don't see a crossover for the same reason that you don't see anything from that. Disorder, the slope doesn't change.
But what's causing it below?
No, it's not an explanation, it's just an observation why you don't see anything when you go through the bucket.
Then is the truth is, you know, the disorder doesn't change the slope, it changes the intercept.
Right.
So it changes the resistivity. So in your explanation, it will change.
You'll see something.
Yeah. So I just showed us data from the latest conference, which is the opposite.
Sorry?
Yeah, I'm just showed us the data conference.
Right,
the
thing. This
slope.
What is just
going? No, that's doping. So let's just take. So if you zinc dope, so if you just disorder it, it just moves up, mm-hmm. and this connects with several things that were mentioned. So this very well obeys the Matthiessen rule, mm-hmm. and so this does not, on the face, at a first pass at least, does not look very hydrodynamic. So it looks, so the residual resistivity, if you disorder it without changing the dope, without changing the density. Right. The residual resistivity goes up, but the slope stays the same.
Up to a point, yeah.
Sorry?
You make it very shitty.
Okay, I don't know what happened.
Okay,
so just to go maybe on a point that was mentioned here, how, when you're talking about the connection of non-Fermi liquid, somehow you translating the scattering time with the imaginary part of the self-energy, right, to make these arguments. But how much of this do we know that is the case? I mean, in the experiment, that the lifetime, the single particle lifetime, and the scattering rate have the same power.
Okay. They don't have.
Exactly, but that's what I'm saying. So how this connection with non-Fermi liquid at low temperatures?
If you have well-defined quasi-particles, then you cannot get there.
It's been measured only in one case, cuprates. Where it is so.
Sure.
It's hard to measure single particles.
Right. Yeah, but Chandra, you were stating it as a bound.
Yeah,
so
it's a bound.
Yeah,
it's a bound. Yeah, well defined particles, you cannot get many.
Smaller than the single particle.
Up to a factor of 2.
Even in three temperatures.
Okay, let me ask this question. Who wants to comment on linear NT resistivity or on additional linear NT behavior with external magnetic field? Or we move to the next subject?
Since it would have been nice if anybody from analytics gang were here.
They will be here next week.
They will, okay. So the issue is that there is data in.
Sorry, do you want this question?
I don't. I just draw something.
This is for the world. It's not for us.
You can hold it.
If I draw it, I don't have to. So in one compound where the resistivity is was measured in zero field to be linear from about 30 Kelvin to 300 Kelvin, which is
this iron
barium. Yeah, this is a big iron one compound, which I've not seen as good a linear resistivity in any other iron pictide. So in this case, they applied, and this is some particular composition, arsenic, phosphorus, and so on, which I can read to you if you're interested. In this case, if you apply a magnetic field, which you're looking, and this is the antiferromagnetic region, if you apply magnetic field where the resistivity is best linear, then resistivity as a function of magnetic field and temperature can be written down as a
I look at the data, I can see some log corrections here, but modulo that, what that means is that when the magnetic field becomes magnetic field in units, when this becomes much larger than kT, the resistivity is linear in magnetic field, and otherwise there are deviations, maybe quadratic deviations. Greg has seen, Greg and his people have seen the same thing in cuprates, and to the level that I'm going to address the issue, the results are identical. These people have more data here, and this thing again only holds in close to this region. Now, in the other very important thing, to my mind, a absolutely revealing thing about the whole thing is that in the iron compound, the edge that we are speaking to, we can rotate the direction of the magnetic field, and the magnetic field that I'm speaking about here is that is relevant is the applied edge times cosine modulus of the cosine of the angle. So it depends on the direction of the field perpendicular to the layers, whether you apply this way and that way. I've repeatedly asked Arkady Schechter and Greg about that in cuprates, and I got the answer that they're still working on it. But I will be absolutely shocked, and I'm willing to bet anything that the same thing will happen in the cuprates.
He worded it a little differently to me.
If
we see anything else, then the experiment is wrong. But that was just, yeah. So we see,
you see that the functional form is different.
So one of the interesting things that the Analytis group reports is this adding in quadrature of the temperature dependence and the magnetic field dependence. Right. So and then they'll use natural units and put a mu bor in front of the H and a kVT in front of the T, and then just fit parameters of an alpha and a beta, and alpha and beta, the ratio is roughly of order one. So we, in fact, our data do not fit the quadrature; they violate it violently, because we actually, and I'll show it on Monday, have a substantial regime where we've got both linear in H and linear in T dependence of resistivity. And so there's no way that a quadrature. So for all data above 50 Tesla and below 40 Kelvin at 0.19 doping, it's linear in H and linear in T.
Yeah, that's why I stuck to this. Even in the analytics data, as I said, there's room for and to the extent that I have pulled over Greg's data, I can fit it by a scaling function with logs. Yeah. Now, let me finish this point. The criticality in the case of quicktites is obvious. It's an easy problem. This is an anti-ferromagnet. But there is an issue about what is the right model for quantum criticality. What is the right quantum statistical mechanical model? If this is a property, it means that any model of isotropic spins is to be thrown out. Okay. The cuprates is a harder problem because our anti-ferromagnetism is here and we are measuring in this regime. Of course, to understand the H dependence, you have to understand the T dependence, but that gets into the realm of theoretical discussion, which I will not use this time to talk about it. There is one issue, but I'm happy to discuss it privately. One important issue about this is that this kind of dependence
cannot come out of any criticality which is a soft mode criticality. It necessarily requires topological excitations, and I will not explain this remark, but I'm happy to discuss it.
Yeah. Okay. There are three questions.
It seemed there were observations of linear in field resistivity in the past, right? Outside of these materials.
I'm aware of them.
Yeah. So, and what makes this situation
different? You combine T and H. Yeah.
Okay, that gets into questions of where it happened and whatnot.
Yeah.
Incidentally, let me make a quick remark about the peculiarity of the aerodynamics in cuprates.
Let's listen to the question.
The question about data. So, in the necktides, what's known about the Hall coefficient? The same temperature.
It's compensated.
In private discussions, I learned that the Hall coefficient also has a scaling in H over T. I don't know what to call it. It is that the Hall coefficient is not a Hall coefficient. It's the resistivity, the Hall resistivity is not linear. In
the right. So what is rho x, y, or sigma? I mean, in cuprates, associated linearity is also this T squared. So it's the terminology similar here.
It's unpublished data that I've seen from analysis on Hall effect, and I would prefer not to.
It's complicated.
It's complicated.
I know there's another paper by Kasahara et al. Reporting the series of compounds where they look at the Kohler's rule, and they could fit with a modified Kohler's rule over a large regime.
The problem at this stage going into much detail about nucleides, which I guess we don't want to do. Arpel.
Maybe you wanted to bring the discussion to, we've been discussing a lot of experiments, but since you're in KIDP, I wanted to know if we have an agreement that there's no known theory that gives linear interior resistivity.
What do you mean, you're going to take a poll?
Why not? I want to raise a discussion. Can I finish? I want to know if this is an agreement, and second, if there's any theory that gives age over T scaling for the resistivity, or if these are two open questions that we have no idea yet how to solve.
Okay. So now we can answer. I have a theory for the linear resistance, which also gives me a linear in H for a particular model. I'm not going to describe that theory now, but I'm happy to entertain you privately.
I want to be entertained.
In conference, I guess it will be safe to say that in all theories that Chandra claimed that failed theories of soft mode, including anti-ferromagnetic fluctuations, etc. I guess most of us agree that you can get linear interior resistivity in two cases. A, above some particular temperature, or B, as a correction to impurities down to the lowest temperature.
But then it should be very...
Okay.
Okay, continue the discussion on this line.
Yes, go ahead.
So, coming back to... this is coming back to what Sean placed strategically on the blackboard for Biedermann France. So it is this gun which you hang at the beginning of the play. This gun is supposed to shoot. So, coming back to what just... Andy said that there are two ways in kind of spin fermion models to describe the linear resistivity. One of them being is that this is just thermal fluctuation. Biedermann France
here. Thermal fluctuation. No, I didn't say what about thermal fluctuations.
It's a thermal.
No.
What did I say?
I said exactly. That there are soft modes. If you go
above the energy of this mode,
then the whole thermal surface becomes hot and you get linear and T just by quantum criticality in this case. I was not referring to thermal flow.
Okay, but let me go back to one of the possible mechanisms, which is there is some soft mode, temperature is above the energy of the soft mode, therefore, for classical reason, we have T. Okay, and what can be said about it? So the test is Riedemann-France.
in the Fonon case, in our copper, we know that linearity of resistivity is accompanied by Wiedemann-Franz, which is violated in the same temperature range. So we know that this is elastic scattering, and therefore it is very much like American Fonon. Now, as far as I know, there is only one set of data which tests the linearity in the cuprates. And this is by Aloy Talifer back from 2001. It's also on this paper. And the test fails. So there is no Wiedemann-Franz satisfied from 100 Kelvin up to 300. That's how high
the
goes. It's a OK. To get rid of the phonons, they do what is called LXY. So it's sigma XY, sorry, kappa XY over T over sigma XY. And as a function of temperature, this is 100, this is 300. The Wiedemann-Franz, which is pi square root over 3, would be here. It starts with about 0.5. For 300, it's still about 2. Right, so it doesn't get it at 300. So this is kind of a litmus test for the soft mode. This is not soft mode scattering, and Wiedemann-Franz is violated in the sense, in the same way it is in a copper. It is below the universal value, which means that it is inelastic scattering. Okay? So on a wish list of things to be measured, Wiedemann-Franz is very high in my priority. So all this linear, I know this is hard, but cases of linearity or resistivity, I think, needs to be checked with Wiedemann-Franz.
Okay, but then if you come up, just connect, just like 1 second. There's one other experiment actually.
Oh, yeah, okay.
So you want on VO2, I can, I think it's nice. So, because the phonons, you know, you'd like to get the high temperatures, the phonons are a bit annoying, perhaps.
So one, right, so this ratio is very nice, but and it'd be greater there are more measure to repeat what Mitya said. But another, so in VO2 actually has a metal insulator trans, so the connectivity, I guess I want to draw, is basically zero, then it jumps, and then there's a T-linear resistivity. Okay? And then you can try to use this jump to your gain. Because the thermal conductivity, I actually don't remember exactly how it goes, but it's something like, so schematically like this. And so what you know is that on this side, the phonons, the thermal conductivity is entirely phonons because it's an insulator. Okay. And so what this paper titles it like enormously low thermal conductivity in VO2, something like that. You could try to subtract, so this jump, so the point is the jump is too big. So Wiedemann-Franz cannot be satisfied. So basically what happens, even before you start subtracting any phonons, so the thermal conductivity is too small, right? So the thermal conductivity goes down a little bit across the metal insulator transition. And so if you, what am I trying to say? That's right, if you take the electrical conductivity, assume the Wiedemann-Franz is valid, the thermal conductivity you get is far too big. Yes, right, it's much bigger than the actual result. So even allowing for the phonons, the electronic component is much smaller than it should be. And so actually you get, you know, trying to be as careful as you can about subtracting out the phonons here, like for the possibility that the phonon dispersions change across the metal insulator transition, right? So you have to worry about that. You get actually something even more dramatic. You get L, so L is this ratio. It's like 0.1, like 0.1 L0. Okay, so again, that's in a T-linear. And so this is also, does not look very phonon-like. It's here. I'm drawing the connectivity because it goes from, better.
Okay, so just let me ask it along the lines that Rafael posted. Who wants to comment on theoretical status of linear interior? Because otherwise we'll move to optical connectivity. We have about 20 something minutes left. Yeah.
Can I just ask a question instead of making a comment?
Sure.
Okay. So one thing that has been touched on a little bit, it's kind of trivial, but it's always bothered me, is the fact that you have in cuprates the linear T that goes over 1,000 degrees, And in principle, people have discussed mostly electronic mechanisms for producing the linear T, but the phonons are there and the electrons are scattering off of them and you don't see changes in slope as a result. The only kind of plausible thing that I know about is some kind of a speed limit bound type analogies. And I'm wondering if you were to comment or maybe elaborate a little bit more on how that could produce an electronic mechanism and it's shunt out the phonon somehow, or does it have to involve a some kind of coupling between the two systems?
Where are the phonons?
Where are the phonons, yeah.
Okay.
But I'm asking, I wasn't pointing at you actually, because he's the one who talked about the bound. But if you're the same, then that's fine, perfect. Whoever wants to answer is fine with me.
The idea, the philosophical idea there is that the phonons could do whatever, if the thing is saturating a limit, you add more scattering and it doesn't do
it. But it has to be a limit for rho over T, right? Not a limit for rho.
I mean, the slope of linear T should change. I think that's the...
Yes.
If the coupling constant is at all significant.
If as people have suggested, the bulk of the scattering rate interpreted loosely, okay? So then you add more scattering channels, you don't really have the bulk.
But do we even have quasi-particles to scatter off in that region?
No, that's why I meant loosely speaking.
Right, well, that's,
so the current dissipation rate.
Okay.
Which is,
so it's nice to formulate it. I don't want to. Like, so I'll follow Sean's example. I don't want to start pushing theory on.
Incidentally,
but a natural quantum. So that's why I like to try to formulate these bounds under diffusivities, which are defined with or without quasi particles. Of course, they're motivated by a sort of quasi particle uncertainty principle type argument. But if you can formulate a bound in terms of it, if you want to formulate a bound, indeed, it better be on something observable, and it doesn't depend on the existence of quasi particles. And the diffusivity is one.
Mm-hmm. Incidentally, Greg may correct me on this. I think there's only one measurement of resistivity to high temperatures in cuprates, and that was lanthanum strontium copper oxide around 1988 by Takagi and Batlogg.
Right, they went.
Have there been any other measurements?
Yeah, there's one that. Also at Bell Labs. On singular BISCO, where he went up to 800, on singular BISCO, Sam Martin went up to 800 Kelvin.
On a single layer BISCO, again, about the same time. But none since.
Right.
Okay, let's stop with this. Let's move on to the next section.
Actually, allow me, I would go to last subject first, because I want to get input from Gil, who is here, and that's something which we said. And that's changing the tone of the discussion, because I think so far we still learn that we don't understand many things. We don't know how it relates the linear to resistivity and, to criticality, etc., etc. But let me kind of formulate a slightly different issue. Do we have a plain vanilla case of quantum criticality where everything works? We can do a controllable theory, not hindered by 1 over n or epsilon expansions breakdown. I write it up in the textbook. Let's see, Pierce Coleman or Eduardo Fraptin will write a chapter about it, and we'll be done. Right? Okay, and the most obvious candidate is the criticality in weak actor magnets, which is a very old subject. So there is a number of bimetallic compounds which thermogenetic order is killed usually by pressure. And this is probably the best known is zirconium zinc 2. There is also palladium doped with nickel. Nickel 3 aluminum, etc. Okay? And in many cases, when the resistivity is measured around critical pressure or around critical concentration, the resistivity behaves as a constant due to a disorder plus T to 5/3
And that's precisely what I would expect from Hertzmeyer's acriticality is equal to 3, d equal to 3. Right? And in some cases, also specific heat was measured. For example, in nickel palladium, goes as C over T log of T, which is also fine.
Could I understand why this works?
Okay, that's what.
Yeah. You know, many people have emphasized that it's small angle scattering.
Yeah. Okay. That's precisely my point. And just to finish kind of the list of our successes, Gill measured thermal conductivity, and thermal conductivity behaves precisely in agreement with this kappa over T, which is the thermal resistivity. Scales with T, which is from the same set of theory as the T to the 13 other resistivity. Now, question comes. Of course, there is a small angle scattering, but there is something more to it, and that's in the theories over the past, when other resistivity was announced to be T to 5/3. What was really done was a calculation of a transport time and then plugging it back into the Drude formula without actually calculating the conductivity. The assumption that somehow a momentum relaxation will take place, and this time will be just there for some reason. And there are two ways that can happen. One is certainly collapse. And there is a problem with collapse when we try to combine them with long-range scattering, which leads to a deviation between a transport time and the lifetime. And that is, for Unklub, we need to satisfy a R condition that k plus p equals to k prime plus p prime plus a reciprocal lattice vector. And if scattering is by small angle, that means that in this R conservation law, at least one of the incoming momenta is going to be very close to one of the outgoing ones. That's kind of glued by adiabatic sediment. So let's say k is almost equal to k prime. We can drop it. And now we see that the difference between two other momenta have to take a large value equal to the reciprocal lattice vector. Okay? So if we try to assemble such a process on a typical 2G Fermi surface, what we're asking is that k is almost near k prime, but then phi and p prime have to be very special points of the Fermi surface, so that the difference p and p prime is equal to b. Okay, but that means that Addison club has extra smallness compared to a transport smallness. So in addition to the transport correction, which scales as 1 over cos theta, and that changes sigma double prime, which is, let's say, 2/3 in 2D, to 1 over tau transport, t to 2/3 in 2D, then there's also a smallness associated with other smallness of these spots, umlaut spots. And if you do the algebra, you'll find that at the scattering rate, becomes irrelevant in the sense that the exponent is either larger than 2 or equal to 2. So then it's not indistinguishable from a Fermi liquid. So if Umklub are effectively disabled, what we have is disorder, right? And if you have, again, I will restore the Boltzmann equation. But now, this is a direct electron collision integral, which is responsible for scattering of electrons mediated by other critical fluctuations of other emerging order parameter. If we are in a Galilean invariant system, as we discussed at the very beginning, there is no contribution of the scattering to the resistivity. But if we are not in a Galilean invariant system, if we are on the lattice, V, which is equal, which is d epsilon dk, is not equal to k over m. And although the momentum is still conserved in the absence of Unklubs, the current isn't. So if I now multiply the Boltzmann equation by V, which is what I need to produce a current here, it wouldn't cancel other collision integral, so I will have a contribution from electron-electron interaction. And then what one can do two limiting cases. One can calculate the resistivity, assuming that the Fermi surface is sufficiently anisotropic. And then what you will get is the residual of resistivity. On top of this, you will have either T to 5/3 in 3D or T to 4/3 in 2D. The caveat here is going to be that there will be also an upper limit, so that if you go into other regime when the electron-electron scattering time becomes much shorter than the electron impurity scattering time, you wouldn't go all the way following the 5/3 law. You will rather saturate at something which is also determined by disorder. So there are two limits, low temperature limit and high temperature limit, and the difference between these two limits in how you average your velocity over the Fermi surface, one way or the other. And if the Fermi surface back is going back to a spherical, the two limits are collapsed. Okay? Now, of course, one can say that one wouldn't see this high temperature saturation because something else will kick in, right? Like phonons. But if you take this theory completely, it will tell you that, yes, you can have a correction of the form of 5/3 to the residual of resistivity, but it is unlikely that you will have a full-blown scaling when the temperature dependent part of resistivity is significantly larger than the residual part. And actually, it turns out that there is one special case when you don't need this condition. This is the case of a compensated semiconductor. So in this case, you don't need help from disorder to establish finite resistivity. It will be finite only if you take into account electron-electron interactions. And I somehow thought that this is fine, but what it has to do to reality, until yesterday when we talked to Gila, I realized that actually most of these materials in this family are compensated semiconductors. And in particular, zirconium 2, it shows the strongest scaling with other resistivity. The temperature-dependent part of other resistivity is by a factor of 10, I think, is larger than the residual part is of this category. So then we are back to kind of normal scenario. We have a mechanism for relaxing the momentum without unclumps or a disorder. And 5/3 works for the reason it's supposed to.
So before there was this delta function due to momentum. To the momentum conservation. So what you're saying, this thing is just a total charge density. And in these compensated metals, this is just zero. And so you just decouple.
I've lost how it's related, unclogged process related to weak ferromagnetism.
You say okay, so weak ferromagnetism means that, well, weak only means that you can start with a TC here, theory of 30 Kelvin, and you have enough pressure to kill it down to zero. Yes. That's
so it would be the same for other materials?
No. So what you need is a second-order continuous quantum phase transition where the acceleration length of the fluctuations of the other parameter becomes large. That tells you that scattering is going to be small angle. Okay. It's kind of a phonon story. So you have T cube and T5. So here the exponents change, but there is one power law in relaxation rate and one in transport.
So could the fact that this is particular to compensated semi-metals be related to other, like manganese silicide or other ferromagnets where this doesn't happen?
So that's what Gil promised me to look into, is there is a counterexample of, let's say, 5/3 or close to 3/2 scaling, which does not happen in a compensated semi-metal. I guess the jury is still out, but
without the jury.
I mean, in experiment, there are always impurities. But if there's a good case of scaling, let's say more than by 10%, which is not a compensate. Because then theory has some problem.
One big picture, just to drive home the point, because this connects to other things, that this is the best possible scenario where the theory is completely under control.
Yeah.
There's a quantum critical point that does not imply a T-linear resistivity. And furthermore, it doesn't even imply scaling of the resistivity, because this interplay with disorder is absolutely crucial. Right? So
unless it can be seen.
And it's stable, there is no one-way end problem in 3D.
So it's
kosher, you know.
It's highlighted because it's shown where the T-linear thing is hard, right? So this is easier than the 2D case, you know, recuperates and so on. But if you just write down the simplest form of critical theory, you really have to worry about momentum relaxation, and that impacts what you see.
Mm-hmm. All right. Unless it's latching and transfer.
You know. Actually, does anyone know of a scaling with T to 4/3 in 2D under similar circumstances?
In 2D?
In 2D. Because 5/3 has been seen. 4/3, I don't know a case.